Are you going to be okay? Like I said, the best. Tell your mother and Coleman that I say the coast is clear for them to come home whenever they want.
But what about you, Daddy?
I'm going to be fine, girl. I have figured what to do so that I don't stare out that window anymore, whining in my mind about jail.
Did you prove them wrong?
She asked. Asia Denise refused to accept that I could be guilty of anything. That will never happen. But I know now how to turn my back on all that.
How?
I'll tell you on the day you graduate from college.
That's too long.
After all I've been through, it's just the blink of an eye.
Can I come to work Monday?
She asked. A week from Monday.
Why till then?
I have work to do.
Can I see you?
I'll call as soon as I can. How's that?
I guess.
I love you, Asia Denise.
I love you too, Daddy.
Goodbye. I was lying on my back with no blankets on the bed of my third floor Montague Street apartment. In my life, I'd been slashed, stabbed, and shot. I'd broken bones and had bruises that went so deep they never fully went away. But I was feeling as young and hopeful as my grandmother in her red gown. The next call rang 8 times before she answered.
Hello?
Willa?
Mr. Oliver, is everything okay?
Perfect.
Do you have any news?
I need you to come to my office at 1 this afternoon.
Does it have to do with what happened to Mr. Braun?
Tangentially.
Okay, I guess. Is it good news?
More like a challenge that might bring the news.
I'll be there.
I'd already talked to Mel, so the next call would be the trickiest. Hello? An old, persistent bluster was already back in the lawyer's tone. Mr. Braun.
Mr. Ball.
I did that. I was referring to the headlines of most of the papers, all except the New York Times. The discovery of the unconscious body of William James Marmot on the downtown doorstep of the NYPD was too tawdry for top billing in all the news that's fit to print. But it did make the lower right corner of the front page.
They brought my daughter back last night. She's unharmed, if a little scared.
I know. They found your friend Marmot with a note pinned to his chest that led them to the house of 2 women in Yonkers. Did you do as I asked?
First, I'd like to know what your plans are for Mr. Mann.
No.
What do you mean, no?
The police know that Marmot was trying to pressure you, but they don't have evidence that you were actually abandoning your client. They don't know about Johanna Mudd.
I had no idea what they were planning to do,
he claimed.
When I realized what had happened, I got sick.
She got dead. That put a cork in the lawyer's whining. I have enough evidence to put you in deep shit, but that's not what you're going to do as I ask.
No?
No.
Tell me.
Marmot was a minnow in the waters around Balance and Pratt. If I suggest to the man who employed him that you know his name, the tables will be turned and Chrissy will be missing an old man.
I do not bend to threats, he said with a certainty he did not have.
Make sure he's in downtown holding and make plans for 5 visitors Monday in the morning and afternoon.
What visitors?
I listed the people I had in mind. 1 or 2 of them surprised him. He asked about them, but I gave him no answers. You do what I ask, I told him, and Chrissy will grow up believing she was visiting with her cousins in Yonkers, and that you are the greatest man in the world. I went down the rope ladder to my office after bathing in the big iron tub. I had slept 11 hours, and the world had moved ever so slightly off its axis. People were milling down the avenue, unaware of the mad machinations I was hatching over their heads. My time in the prison cell, Gladstone Palmer's betrayals, even the loss of my shield, no longer had a hold on my soul. I picked up All Quiet on the Western Front and read without a break until the buzzer of my office door sounded. Willa was wearing a blue dress reminding me of the femme fatale of one of my favorite novels. Her hair was up, and seeing her red lips, I realized that she hadn't worn makeup at our first meetings.
Mr. Oliver.
You look gorgeous.
Thank you.
Come on in. I sat at Asia's desk, and Willa took the seat across. She was looking very good, and I wondered why. Was this an attempt to make sure that I helped her one-night lover?
I read the in-depth article about Mr. Braun in the paper this morning, she said. I had no idea that his daughter had been taken.
That's why he was backing off.
He called and said that he wanted me to meet with Manny on Monday at noon.
That's what I want. He was just a mouthpiece. Willa got the joke and smiled. I'm going to ask you to go off the reservation, I said.
What does that mean?
In a little while, a man will come here and he's going to give you a note that we want you to bring to Man. There's an item in the note that is vital to his case.
Vital in what sense?
I can't answer because of, what do you lawyers call it? Oh, yeah, plausible deniability. Just bring him what my friend gives you.
They search you too closely for something like that.
My friend has been smuggling contraband for his entire life.
In prison?
I nodded, and a hint of concern entered her eyes.
I love him, she said, connecting the fear with this revelation. I don't want him hurt.
I smiled.
You find that funny?
She asked, the woman she'd become echoing in her tone. You got a man with his comrades mostly slaughtered, and him sitting on death row for the murder of two cops. His lawyer has betrayed him. Judges in the high court are whispering that he will most certainly die. And here you think I might be the one to bring him pain.
What about his wife and child?
What about them?
Shouldn't they be made aware of your plans?
I will not share my plans with you or anyone else, but if everything works out, Mr. Mann will be able to make his own decisions. I could see that she was about to ask another question, and many more after that, but then the buzzer sounded. I didn't even look through the peephole. Mel was standing there, wearing a corn-colored suit with a black shirt underneath. We didn't speak. I walked him over to the desk, and Willa stood. She was both fascinated by and afraid of this man. He looked at her like an evolved tiger might, through self-imposed bars. Mel pulled up a chair. After her usual hesitation, Willa sat too. Those few days held the most potent experiences in my life up until that point. It was as if every nerve had the volume turned up, and every perception had a dozen meanings, all of which I understood and profited from. This is going to be a short meeting, I said, then turning to Willa. My friend here is going to give you something, and you will take it into that room for private meetings with lawyers. You will give him the packet and say that you got it from a friend. Don't tell him any names. Do not indicate anything about us, including gender, knowledge we might have, or about any investigation. He will take the item and make up his own mind.
What will the note say?
Willa asked.
That has to be between us and him,
Mel said in a surprisingly soothing voice.
That way, everyone is protected.
They search you down to your underwear when you go in to visit a death row inmate.
Mel reached into his pocket and came out with a small box with the name A Summer's Day, printed over a field of wind-blown grasses. It was a popular feminine hygiene product, a packet of 3 tampons. He handed the box to the young lawyer, and she took it.
The seals are intact, and the price is stamped on the bottom, he said.
But I won't be having my period Monday.
Then it must be coming on,
he said, with an irrepressible, wolfish tone. Just give him the packet, I said. The note is inside.
Tell him to keep it hidden and tear it open when he's back in his cell,
Mel added.
If you follow these instructions to the letter, he will have a 50-50 chance of being saved.
What does that mean?
She asked, looking directly into my friend's dead eyes.
If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
Her nostrils flared, and I wondered if she was turned on by the power pulsating behind those words.
Okay,
Willa said to me.
That's it?
That's it.
After she was gone, I took out a very old port and served.
You think she'll do what we said?
Mel asked.
I'm pretty sure. He's a man she loves, and we're the only show in town.
The only one,
Mel agreed.
Now, how about this place?
It's called Treacher Admitting on Maiden Lane, just a couple blocks east of Broadway.
I've never seen it.
It doesn't advertise. They mostly serve rich patients from Wall Street, but they have a deal with law enforcement, free medical attention for certain protections.
I paused and then asked,
what about the powder?
It's what they call a derivation of the Shigella bacteria,
Mel explained.
Targets the appendix, but has a short lifespan, just long enough for our purposes.
Not that I'm complaining, I said. But how does a self-educated heist man turned watchmaker get his hands on something like that?
Whenever I get put away, I try for the sentence to be carried out in a prison where there's a lot of Russians. They always have the most organized gangs, and they're connected to people from the old country and Eastern Europe in general. Those people often have ties to intelligence. This little poison comes straight from the defunct laboratories of the KGB.
Damn. I was impressed. I'll get you the plans to the clinic. Their security is not so strong, seeing that they rely on the cops and the fact that nobody knows they're there. Because there's so many cops, I need to stay away as long as I can.
I got that covered.
We finished our wines, and then poured two more. 36. I spent Sunday morning wondering how I kept my lawless side down for so long. That train of thought brought me to the realization that I no longer missed being a policeman. I'd been a good cop, in my own estimation, but that shit nearly got me killed. I wasn't a criminal, not exactly. But those flexible rules of law could not bend as far as I was willing to go, as I needed to go. The internet news told of how William James Marmot had a crazy story of being kidnapped, shot, tortured, and then made to write the confession pinned to his chest. Under the threat of death, he merely wrote what his masked captor dictated. He was a victim and not a criminal mastermind. Marmot was put in a hospital, but sometime after midnight, he evaded his police guard and effectively disappeared. I went to a reinvented old-time boxing gym in Dumbo at noon. There I lifted some weights and did a dance with the heavy bag for an hour or so. When I got back to the office, there was a message on my office line.
Mr. Oliver, this is Reggie Teeks. I'm an unofficial representative of the parties that you've been negotiating with. We would all like to keep this matter outside the legal system, and so if you call me, we can meet, and I will offer you a settlement on behalf of my clients.
He left a phone number that I was sure could not be traced. I considered calling Mel, but decided that I shouldn't rely too heavily on him. I thought that maybe it would have been prudent to wait a week or so before responding, but that didn't feel right either. Something about Teague's request sounded like an immediate threat.
Mr. Oliver, he said upon answering.
I had walked all the way to Park Slope to call him from a phone booth in a small restaurant I frequented. It could have been a call from anybody, but he knew that the only ring that line would be getting had to be from me. So, I said, what is it?
We have to meet.
I haven't been very lucky with clandestine meetings in this century, I said.
You chose the place.
Columbus Circle Mall, fourth floor wine bar, I said. In 30 minutes.
Done. You'll know me because I will be the only man there wearing a herringbone jacket with an orange bow tie.
I reached the fourth floor, inside, open-air wine bar, in 28 minutes. He was drinking cognac from a snifter and looking about him like some kind of humanoid alien examining the rituals of an alien species in a forsaken corner of his cosmic domain. Preternaturally thin, he was what passed as a white man, but his coloring was olive and his black eyes were startling, even from a distance. I told the hostess that I saw my friend. She smiled and moved aside. As I walked toward him, he took no special notice. This told me that he wasn't armed with a photograph.
Mr. Teeks?
Due to his slender build and finicky attire, I expected the professional middleman to be shorter than I. But as he unfolded himself from the chair, he rose and rose until I was looking up into his void-colored eyes. He took inventory of me, my Crayola blue suit and black canvas shoes, worn in case I had to run. I had to concentrate to keep my hands from writhing nervously. This strange man unnerved me. His smile revealed very bright but tiny teeth.
"Mr. Oliver," he greeted, holding out a hand. "So glad you decided to come."
I shook the hand and took the chair across the small circular table from him. The wine bar, it had no name I knew of, wasn't very crowded. We sat next to the outer wall, looking down the atrium to the entrance hall 3 floors below. I chose that particular place because no matter the economic state of the nation or the world, that mall was always crowded because it catered to the upper classes, who, it seemed, were never at a loss for disposable income. We were sitting in an isolated corner, so my host spoke clearly and at a decent volume.
"There was a regrettable decision to end your life," he said, as if talking about a small dog that had taken a shit on my rose bushes. "We apologize for that lapse in judgment."
This answered my first question. Teagues worked for whoever it was who used Gladstone to frame me back in the days when I was a cop.
"Whatever happened with that?"
"The agent who took the unconsidered decision upon himself has been dealt with. You don't have to worry about him anymore."
"What about his accomplices?"
"One has moved on, and the other has simply gone away."
I liked the way Teagues talked. His references could be either vague or rock solid. "Why would you apologize if it was Convert who took it upon himself to do what was done? I wasn't as accomplished a conversationalist as Reggie Teagues."
"If a man represents another man, then the man in charge has to take responsibility. That rule is what Western civilization is based upon."
"And are you the man in charge?"
Showing his small-toothed grin again, he said, "Heavens no, I am merely a fulcrum, the man who attempts to achieve parity among the parties involved."
"I could have used somebody like you a long time ago."
"As I have said, there have been mistakes made."
"You talk about this shit like you stepped on my toe or brought me a black coffee instead of one with cream."
"Come on now, Joe," the fulcrum said reasonably. "Men have died in this arena. I'm here to offer you recompense."
"What kind of recompense?" Teagues reached under the table, pulling out a dull, buff-colored leather satchel. He said,
$450,000 in untraceable bills."
If I was still a cop, I would have walked away right then. Even if I had just considered myself loyal to the clan that abandoned me, I would have said no. As merely a responsible citizen, the negation was on the tip of my tongue. Teagues saw this and said,
"Before you make a rash decision, Mr. Oliver, let me say that the people on the other side would feel quite nervous if you were to refuse their offer."
"I could send Asia Denise to college with money like that. And there were the costs that the next day's jobs would incur. The most I could hope for was some kind of payoff, be it from a judgment or from the conniving of some lawyer like Stuart Braun."
"Your pain is undeniable,"
Teagues said, trying to drive the point home.
"But despite our lapses, you are still alive."
"If I take that satchel, the people you represent will back off?"
"Like the darkness at the break of day."
"And if I don't take it?"
"I have no words for that consequence."
I returned that evening to my office with a pigskin satchel and more money than I'd ever had. I put on a duet by Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. They played those horns like maniacs finally released from the asylum of humanity. I listened to the piece over and over, thinking about the victims whom I'd uncovered and, to some degree, whom I had avenged. I thought about the truth that undergirded the lies circulated by the institutions of governments, large and small. That was, I knew, my excuse for taking the payoff. 37. Asia called me in the morning. They were back from Florida, and she wanted to ditch school to meet me for lunch. I was her father and should have said no, but instead I agreed and called the school, telling them I was keeping her out for the day. We met at noon at our favorite pizza place across the avenue from Lincoln Center. There they made simple pizzas on the thinnest crust imaginable. "What happened to your hair?" was the first thing she said. "I thought I'd take up track," I joked. "Cutting off my hair makes me aerodynamic." She wasn't amused.
"Are you okay now, Daddy?"
Instead of answering, I hugged and kissed her. Then we sat at a window table. "Almost."
"Why only almost?"
"The best thing I can ever teach you, honey, is that the truth will kick you in the ass." She giggled. Then the waitress came to take our order.
"Are you getting kicked at by the truth?"
Asia asked me when the server departed.
"Yeah."
"Can I help?"
"You know how I was getting on you about how you were dressed?"
"Yeah."
"Whenever I do something like that, you should listen to what I say, but do what you want."
"I usually do," she said.
"Don't I know it?"
"But you're almost always right, Daddy."
The concern on her face made her look older and, in my opinion, even more beautiful.
"I was real worried about you when we went away," she added. "I hardly slept at all. One night I woke up and found Mom sitting on the couch in our suite."
"You had a suite?"
"Coleman said that we should have it so that we were together. He was pretty scared."
"What about your mother?"
"I told her how worried I was about you, and she said that she was too."
"Really?"
"Uh-huh. You know what she said?"
"I couldn't even imagine."
"She said that she shouldn't have abandoned you all those years ago when that policewoman showed her the tapes of you with another woman."
"She told you about that?"
"Just about that she saw you with somebody. But she said that you were a good man and she knew it, but she was just so mad that it was like somebody else was there making her turn her back on you. She said that she was still mad, but now she knows that that shouldn't have mattered, and she should have had your back. She said that you guys should have worked it out, and maybe you wouldn't be in so much trouble today. I told her she should tell you all that when we got back, but she said that she never could, that it would be wrong for a married woman to say something like that to another man."
"Whoa. Then why are you telling me?"
"Because usually when Mom doesn't want you to know something, she says not to tell. That's how I knew she wanted you to know how she felt."
The waitress brought our pizzas and salads, giving me a respite in which to think.
"So?"
Asia asked when our server, whose chipped blue name tag read Marianne, had gone again. "So what?
Are you gonna ask Mom to get back together?"
That was the perfect moment for me to do what I had come there for. I reached into my inside jacket pocket and came out with a small brown envelope made from tough plastic. The letter was sealed, and I handed it over to the person I loved the most in the world.
"What's this?"
"If I'm ever hurt or in big trouble, I want you to open this and do what it says. Put it away somewhere safe, somewhere where neither your mother nor Coleman will find it."
"I know a place,"
Asia said with convincing certainty.
"But what does it say?"
"You will probably never have to find out." I didn't want to worry, but $300,000 of my bride money would be in a safe deposit box where only she and I were signatories.
"What about you and Mom?"
she asked, putting the envelope in her purse. "Asia Denise, do you really want me and your mother under the same roof after all these years of fighting?" I could see her imagining what that union would be like. After a moment, her eyes opened wide, and then she smiled.
"Never mind."
38. I met Mel at a diner called Clown's Carnival, 4 blocks away from the semi-secret clinic. It was a few minutes past 8. I had on my fake facial hair just in case there was some errant CCTV feed lurking above. Mel was all in black. I was, too, under my bulky, umber overcoat.
The layout of the place is a little out of date, he told me after we'd greeted and I ordered coffee.
Yeah? How'd you find that out?
Building permits. City has a website for all construction work. They weren't hiding because the cops keep it on the down low, like you said. They installed all kinds of security to keep people out up front, but the back of the building is the same as it always was.
There is no back of the building, I said. Treacher's shares a back wall with Kershaw and Associates.
Au contraire, the sophisticated demon argued. There's a 2-foot space between the clinic and Kershaw after the 6th floor, and most of the fancy security updates are on the 9th floor. There's only one hospital bed up on that level. All we have to do is make it up there now, break into the floor, and then wait nearby until they bring our guy in. Once that happens, and we see how the guards are placed, we decide on how to get him out. Only thing I want to know is if you're willing to use deadly force.
You mean kill a cop? Mel didn't even nod. No, man. This is about not murdering.
Okay. I gotcha. I know how to spin it. But considering on how things might go, it could make it that much more difficult to get through.
There was a side door to Kershaw and Associates. Mel had been in and out of the building over the past few days and had put together a plan for us to enter unnoticed. That particular side door had no camera on it, and he had fixed the lock so that it only appeared to work properly. We made our way in and up to the 8th floor. There, we jimmied the locks of the offices of Meyer, Meyer, and Goldfarb. I couldn't tell by their walls or desks what business MM&G were in, but it didn't much matter. The 8th stage of the Kershaw building was halfway between the 8th and 9th floors of the building that housed Treacher Admitting. I had brought a go-bag with all the tools a burglar might need. We had to completely remove the unused window that looked out onto the slender divide between the two buildings. I had 2 crowbars for that job. We wedged a metal chair between our window and Treacher's wall. From there, one after another, we crawled up high enough to make it through the hospital room window. We had to break the lock, but Mel put it back together well enough that it looked okay if you didn't inspect it too closely. Then we used a half-chewed piece of gum to attach a tiny transmitter under the hospital bed and made our way back down to MM&G. That was our time to wait. We had a tiny speaker receiving a continuous feed from the transmitter in the room. When something happened there, we would hear it. So for the next 3 hours, we sat in darkness and silence. It was a fairly simple plan. The note hidden in the tampon, printed in block letters called from the internet, told a free man that if he wanted to be free, he should take the powder folded in a small cellophane envelope that accompanied the note, at any time between 11 at night and 2 in the morning. This would give him abdominal pains and a fever. He should call a guard at the first signs of these symptoms, and that's all he had to do. We waited. I don't believe either of us uttered a word in that time. But even though I didn't chatter, my mind was filled with excitement, fear, and even some remorse. I was not an extortionist, rapist, even though I had had sex with the woman calling herself Natalie Malcolm. A free man was not a murderer, even though he had shot and killed the 2 policemen who had betrayed their oaths and tried to murder him. We were both mostly innocent men, slated to take the fall for the real criminals. We would never receive justice from law enforcement or the courts, and so the only thing that could be done was to take the law into our own hands. This decision frightened me. Taking these steps brought me to a place I had never been, a place that I had always thought was wrong. And it was wrong. My demon friend and I were executing an honest-to-God prison break. For a man with my history, that was just about as bad as you could get. There were butterflies all through my body. I felt as if I were damned. But still, I knew that this was the only course left open to me.
Bring him in here,
a woman commanded over the small speaker on the desk between us. The time was 1:57 a.m. There were sounds of squeaky rubber wheels on the linoleum floor, and the squealing of metal frames moving and sometimes bumping into other objects.
Put him on the bed, the woman said.
Lift,
a man said.
Then we heard the less definable sounds of a body being hefted and moved, probably from a gurney, to the bed.
"You don't need to restrain him," the woman complained. "He has a fever of 103.
"Ma'am, this here is a convicted cop killer. As far as I'm concerned, we could have let him die in his cell. But as long as he's here, he will be chained to this bed."
There were more sounds and some conversation. Mel and I were on high alert. I no longer worried about right and wrong because it was a time for action.
"He has all the symptoms of appendicitis, but that's not what I'm seeing," the woman said.
"Should we take him back?"
a man I had not heard before asked.
"No,"
the woman doctor said.
"I want to observe him for 24 hours at least. If this is some kind of communicable infection, I'd like to isolate it before it spreads through your jail."
"You mean we could catch this?"
"I don't know, but I'd like to see what happens."
"Arcady," the first man who spoke said. "Yes, sir?" "Set up outside this room and don't go to sleep."
"What about if it's catching, Sergeant?"
Arcady asked. "That's why God invented medical insurance."
The doctor and cops talked for a while more. Most of the police left. For the next 20 or 30 minutes, we could hear someone, probably the doctor, moving around the room. And then, for 34 minutes, there was silence. As quietly as he could, Mel climbed out on our ladder chair and lifted himself up to look through the hospital room window. Then he opened the window and climbed through. I followed as soundlessly as possible and clambered into the dark room. We'd been wearing gloves since entering the Kershaw building. Before we crossed over to the clinic the first time, we had donned dark ski masks. A drawn and unconscious free man was chained to his hospital bed. His dreadlocks were tangled, and there was a twist to his lips. I had a bolt cutter and so used it on the restraint that chained man to the bed frame. In the meanwhile, Mel was fashioning a shoulder harness from thick rope that he intended to use to lower the unconscious Mr. Man from one building to the next. I hefted the tangle-headed man up into a seated position, and Mel began to loop the jury-rigged harness around the left shoulder. That was when the door burst open, and the light came on. Time froze for a moment there. Officer Arcady had taken on too much, what with opening the door and turning on the light. He probably heard something and thought it was man trying to get out of his cuffs and so had not drawn his weapon. He did, however, reach for his piece when he saw us. Mel was faster. The habitual offender swiveled to the right and fired 5 shots, which sounded like no more than pops. Arcady was hit in both legs and both arms. Then Mel rushed the faltering cop and hit him in the center of his forehead with the barrel of the gun. The cop, who was portly of build, hit the floor like a dead bull, and Mel was quick to use the man's own handcuffs to restrain him. I thought that this was going a little overboard when I noticed there was no blood coming from Arcady's extremities. Mel noticed me looking and said, "Rubber bullets." Then he took a metal hypodermic from a pouch at his side and administered what I figured was some kind of knockout concoction. While this was going on, I ran out into the hall and located a wheelchair. When I came back in, my cohort asked,
"What do you plan to do with that?"
"No sentry. We could take the elevator."
"What if they got cameras? This place is for VIP clients. They don't want electric eyes following them."
Mel's grin actually filled me with pride.
"I'll go back down to Kershaw and take our stuff out of there," he said. "You got those whiskers on, so don't have to wear no mask. Once you get out, head west toward Broadway. I'll grab the van and snag you on the way."
It was the right plan, but I felt like a rat in a trap waiting for that elevator and then taking it down. Even when I made it to the delivery exit on the bottom floor, my heart was going at a triple rate. Mel had handed me his pistol, but that didn't give me any solace. I'd spend the rest of my life in prison if I was captured. All of that said, there was a feeling of elation in my fast heart that I never had before or since. On the side street sidewalk, I began pushing the wheelchair. All of the clinic's security was aimed at keeping unwanteds out. No one was expected to try to escape. Even though man was sedated when we found him, Melcourth had given him a shot of his tranquilizer.
"You had 2 hypodermics?
I asked.
"I got a gun with real bullets, too. Same reason you brought along those crowbars, to get the job done."
We had strapped the thin, long-haired man with restraints that the chair provided. I looked down through his dreadlocks. His dark brown skin could have been mine. The handsome slant of his face might have belonged to a radical historian college professor. It was cold outside. I could see that in the mist from my breath, but I didn't feel it. Up ahead, I saw the red and blue flashes of a police car. These passed by the intersection of Broadway and Maiden Lane.
"Hey!"
Mel called. He pulled to the curb just behind me. His van was middle green, and there was a sign on the side that read, "Hobart and Sons Construction." We left the wheelchair at the curb and lay man's inert form on a mattress on the floor. I sat back there with him while Mel drove. We made it through the Holland Tunnel to Jersey City, and then took 95 to 78 past Newark International, and on, 20 miles or so past Elizabeth, arriving at a private airport. I spent most of that time making sure man didn't bounce around too much. The elation was flaring inside me. I had done something, something real. This meant more to me than anything other than the birth of my daughter. We were allowed in by a security guard at the gate to the airfield. He was a short white guy with a huge face.
"Who are you?"
he asked Mel, the driver.
"Landsman,"
my friend said. It was the code name I gave to my grandmother's billionaire boyfriend.
"Your pilot is already here."
The pilot was a tall, very handsome Hispanic man who told us to call him Jack. The three of us carried man into the small jet and strapped him into yet another chair. My only interaction with a free man was with his unconscious body. It was as if, I suppose, I was his dream, an apparition that he'd never remember, but that changed his life.
"I know Jack here," Mel said to me while the pilot made ready at the controls. "I'll go down with him to Panama City and make sure your boy's settled in."
"I should go with you. You've been talking to people about this guy, right?"
"Yeah." "That means you should be living your normal everyday life, in case anybody wants to look at you. Also, we need to get this van away from where your friend's airplane is to keep you out of that. I mean, we don't know if maybe somebody saw us drive away."
"Don't worry, Joe. I didn't go through all of this to trick you now." He was right, and I really didn't want to go away just then. "You brought my duffel bag down from that office?" I asked.
"Yeah."
He rummaged around the back and gave it to me. I pulled out the leather satchel that Teagues had given me. "There's $150,000 in here. $25,000 is to cover your costs. After you pay the pilot, the rest is for man." Mel took the satchel and smiled.
"You see that, Joe? A man like Mr. Man here is one of my people. And there you are on the other side of the wall, doing what's right.
You better get out of here before we start kissing or something." I parked the van in the long-term section of an automated underground parking lot. I had a hat and my whiskers, and hope in my heart that there was no camera to see my disguise. Then I took the train from Newark back to Manhattan, and the A train, which ran local after 10 p.m., to High Street in Brooklyn. 39. I got to bed by noon and slept for 19 hours without even getting up to urinate. In the early morning, I read all about the daring prison escape. Stuart Braun had set up 7 visitors for his client. The man's wife, 3 doctors, Willa Portman, of course, Stuart himself, and a Catholic priest for prayer. All were questioned. None were held. The investigation would go on for decades, if I was lucky. Even if Willa told about the package we gave her, she had no proof of what was in it. Our note told man to destroy and discard the note and packaging after taking his powder. I should have been afraid, but that was nothing but joy for me that morning. In the following days, Asia came back to work. The only thing she said was that she knew what happened, and we never had to talk about it. On Friday, Mel dropped by and gave me a small memory chip.
"I gave him what money there was," Mel said. "He recorded a message for his wife. I watched it and heard what he had to say. He didn't mention a thing that would get him or us in trouble."
He took a slip of paper from a pocket and handed it to me.
"Here's his mother-in-law's address. Print out a note that says, 'For Honey Mama and Lil Sugar,' and she will make sure it gets there."
Later that day, the buzzer to my apartment sounded.
Yeah? I said into the intercom.
It's Gladstone.
I hesitated, but then decided that whatever my ex-friend had to say, I should hear him out. We were sitting at my table desk drinking Irish whiskey that Gladstone brought. After some small talk, he said,
I hear that they made a settlement with you.
Maybe.
That guy Teeks is a trip, right?
Why are you here, Glad?
I know you feel like I sold you out, Joe, but the way I look at it, I saved your life. I couldn't have stopped them from doing something. I tried to tell them to pay you off then, but they said they couldn't take the chance.
They were probably right, I said. Back then, I was blue all the way to the core.
And you aren't anymore?
I took in a deep breath and looked at my friend. It's okay, Glad. I get it now. Back then, I didn't understand. I thought I knew the rules, but now I see that the rules don't cover every damn thing. My eternally smiling friend frowned a little then.
You still want to be in that poker game?
Sure I do. After all you did, I should let you win a little of that money. And you're right. You did save my life. Late that night, I put the memory chip into a reader connected to my computer. An icon appeared on the screen, and I clicked on it. Immediately, the image of a free man appeared. He was wearing a loose shirt of a yellow hue. His dreads were tied back and then piled up at the back of his head. His smile seemed to want to lift up off his face and fly around his head. Hey, babe, I went to sleep a condemned man and woke up in freedom. I'm in the bright sun and as happy as a man could be. I can't tell you where I am or how I got here, but you and Lil Sugar have to know that I love you, and we'll be together as soon as I can make that happen. I will be in touch, and if you need to get to me, all you have to do is remember that North Blue thing we used to do. Hi, Lil Sugar. I know you're there, too. I love you, and I never did anything wrong. Don't listen to what they say. Your heart knows the truth.
I felt that I was set free, along with May. It was a deep, grinding feeling that hurt, but at the same time, felt like the hand of some momentary apparition of God. This has been a Hachette Audio production of Down the River, Unto the Sea, written by Walter Mosley, read by Dion Graham, produced by Michelle McGonigal, directed by Graham Malcolm, recorded by Michelle Figueroa, post-production by John Colucci. Down the River, Unto the Sea is also available in print and as an ebook from Mulholland Books, an imprint of Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by The Thing Itself, Incorporated. Audio production copyright 2018 by Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions at hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. And any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.